Welcome to Dad's on the Air for the 18th of September 2007. Cold day here in Sydney. Got an interesting show coming up. We have a Canberra bureaucrat, John Pearson, detailing the vagaries of the entire system. We've got a chap who's just put up a new website fighting taxpayer-funded injustice. We've got Warwick Marsh from the Fatherhood Foundation and lots of other material. So welcome to everyone who's joining us from around the world via live streaming on the 2GLF website. And don't forget, if you want to listen to the program later, you can listen to that at www.dadsontheair.net. We've got in the studio Ian Purdy, the author of
The Daddy's Split Guide. Thank you, John, for introducing me and my book, which is now available, coincidentally, on lulu.com. So anybody who hasn't yet got their copy of The Daddy's Split Guide by Ian Purdy can purchase it from www.lulu.com. And, of course, we also have Greg Andreessen in the studio as well. Greg, would you like to do a little introduction about yourself?
Unfortunately, I have no products to sell at the moment, but I'd like to just say g'day to all the listeners out there.
My name's John Stapleton. We've also got coming up next week Joshua Key. He's a soldier that's been fighting in Iraq. Hopefully he'll be on the show. He's just written a book called The Deserter's Tale, Why I Walked Away from the War in Iraq. And just to give you a sample of that, one of the things that disturbed me the most in the house raids was having to run into bedrooms and round up sleeping Iraqi children. I couldn't help imagining how my own children would react if armed soldiers from another country burst into their rooms and tore them from bed. I was supposed to keep my guns trained on the children when I woke them, got them out of bed and marched them outside. I couldn't do it. I could never point my M249 at a child. I would tap them gently on the shoulder and the poor kids would leap from bed, petrified, screaming like the world was ending. And outside they would go as their brothers and fathers were being zip-cuffed and shoved into the back of trucks and sent out to who knows where. What a wonderful war. It's Iraq.
Well, that's absolutely, and there's lots of tragic stories. Of course, we had Eric Birch, the soldier who has been releasing songs that we've been playing on Dad's on the Air, who was a serviceman who returned from Iraq to find that his family had fallen apart. And there's an even more tragic case that has happened recently. A little girl, a two-year-old girl called Kelsey, whose father was serving in Iraq and who was abused to death, basically beaten to death by her stepfather. The mother, Ray Dawn Smith, has been sentenced to 27 years in jail for Kelsey's death. Was complicit in the beating at the hands of her new boyfriend, the stepfather, while the father was away serving his country in Iraq. This is an absolute tragedy, and our heart goes out to all of the family and everybody involved in this absolutely horrifically tragic case of little two-year-old Kelsey beaten to death by her stepfather while her father was away serving his country in Iraq.
There's a lot of horror stories around this morning. And what about this one, a three-year-old girl that's been left on a train station in Melbourne?
Well, this one's a shocker. I mean, on the surface of it, this just looks terrible. This would seem to back up all of the feminist propaganda that says that fathers are useless people that are not fit to look after children. The Daily Telegraph, Anthony Dawsley and Carly Crawford write, a three-country manhunt has been launched for a father who abandoned toddler Pumpkin at a Melbourne railway station before fleeing overseas. The Daily Telegraph can reveal Nai Zun Zhu dumped his daughter on Saturday at the CBD Southern Cross station after buying a plane ticket to Los Angeles a day earlier in Melbourne. Now, on the face of it, we don't know the details of this case. Apparently the mother is also missing. I would imagine that there's a lot more than meets the eye in this case, and over the next hopefully very soon we're going to find out the details of what it was that actually drove a man, a father, to abandon his three-year-old daughter in a railway station. I personally, as a father, can't imagine any circumstance that would cause a father into this behaviour. I'm hoping that some kind of extenuating circumstance is going to be revealed over the next coming weeks, and we're going to find out. Well, I can't imagine it's going to be a good story. There's fears of the mother's safety. This is a shocking story. Fortunately, the little girl is safe. She's with foster parents at the moment who are looking after her.
She actually appeared in very good shape when they picked her up. They the footage, CCTV footage of the bloke walking away and leaving her on the station. It took about 15 minutes for the station authorities to notice her just wandering around without anyone. She was very well dressed in the sort of top of the range clothes. Well, both which is how she got a nickname. That's a pumpkin range clothes, apparently, which is, you know, very top notch. So,
yeah, well, her mother's apparently is a magazine publisher in New Zealand. So these are reasonably educated, wealthy people. So one really can only wonder what's going on behind the scenes in this case that has caused a family to behave so dysfunctionally.
Tyranny everywhere you look. Take away kids from drug-addicted parents, says Liberal MP Bronwyn Bishop. She's calling for more children of drug-addicted parents to be permanently removed from their parents and offered for adoption. She wants to see adoption rather than fostering used to separate children from parents who are battling addiction. The backbencher who's currently chairing, or she's just finished a parliamentary inquiry into the impact of illicit drug use in families, told the ABC the system was skewed towards the interests of the parents and not their children. She said there are hundreds and hundreds of parents who are desperate to adopt children and give love and good homes.
Well, go Bronny. She obviously doesn't pay much regard to biological connection and thinks that just anybody will do, but that doesn't really, the science doesn't back that up, that children want to know their biological parents. And she even suggests that, that parents who have recovered from drug addiction should also... the children should stay away, should be kept away, that if they're put into foster care, that the parents, even if they do go through rehabilitation and kick their habit, whatever it is, stop using drugs, that they should still not be able to have access to the children. I personally think that's disgraceful. I think that's a sign of that Bronwyn Bishop is archaic. She's an anachronism from another age when it was all right like to take the Aboriginal children away from their parents. We'll now take the drug addicts' children away from them. Personally, I don't think this is the answer to anything. It's just going to create more social problems, more drug addicts, and more questions than it's going to answer.
The Victorian Child Safety Commissioner, Bernie Geary, said he'd seen some drug users who were better parents than non-users. And Mr. Geary said he'd seen them go into a period of contemplation and then become more than adequate parents. So it's a complex and convoluted topic, but Bronwyn Bishop has definitely come down on the side of arbitrary removal. Where do you draw the line, though? If you took the kids off every parent in this country who'd ever smoked a joint, there wouldn't be many. There'd
exactly.
be a lot of very packed institutions.
Well, it just you can't have a one-size-fits-all solution. Every case is different, and for her to be putting forward a simplistic solution like this, I think just shows that, well, not much subtlety or intelligence behind that particular politician.
Mind you, you do see some absolutely appalling circumstances. Sit on a few public train stations for a few days and tell me there isn't a problem. We'll be back in a moment.
Goes around. claimed. You said that you were moving on now. Maybe I should do the same. The funny thing about that is I was ready to give you my name. Thought it was me and you, baby. And now it's all just a shame. And I guess I was wrong.
Don't wanna think about
no.
it. Don't wanna talk about it. I'm just so sick about it.
Can't believe it's ending this way.
I'm just so confused about it. Feeling the blues about it. I just can't do it.
Can you tell me, is this fair?
Is this the way it's really going down? Is this how we say goodbye? Should've known better when it came around.
Should've known better
that you were gonna make me cry.
And I was breaking my heart to watch you run around. I know that you're living a lie.
That's okay, baby, cause in time you will find
got Max on the phone, have we there? Max?
Yeah, hi, Josh.
Right, hi, welcome to Dad's on the Air.
Good, thanks for the opportunity.
Now, you've just set up a website, Tax Funded Prejudice. Can you just tell everyone?
Well, it's just Tax Funded Prejudice, so
yeah.
Hopefully that'll .com, that'll hopefully help people find it. Basically, I've just set it up because I think it's something that no one else is really doing. I wanted to try and add something to the movement that wasn't really being done anywhere else and sort of directly confront what I think is really about prejudice, and a lot of it is tax funded, so that's what the site's about. I think the last inquiry didn't provide a lot of education and didn't really confront prejudice. All those submissions were really lost and didn't get carried forward.
No, it was a huge lost opportunity, the family law process here in Australia during the earlier part of the millennium. Huge waste of effort. What can you just go through some of the content that's on the site and where you want to take it?
I suppose the two things that I'm looking at now is the fact that the two main things is that property settlements were left off the last inquiry. So that's something that we can push for, and Ruddock can't argue that, oh, no, we've already had an inquiry into that. We don't need to do it again. But so we can bring up all the issues with property settlements that were left off. And I think that's something we should be running with. And also, before the end of this year, probably in the election cycle, the citizenship thing will be debated. The citizenship document with Australian values, which sort of goes out big on, you know, men created, men and women equal and equal treatment under Australian laws and things like that. But that's not actually true in things like the Sex Discrimination Act and a whole lot of other public policy.
Well, even something like rape. I mean, rape is a specifically sexist crime. I've never heard of a woman being charged with raping a man.
Yeah. I think there have been a few charges, but there's certainly a lot less sentences and they tend to get off.
Yeah, we don't tend to have gangs of teenage girls marauding the suburbs, raping blokes in parks and stuff like that, although that probably wouldn't be seen as the same magnitude of problem as if it happens the other way around.
Well, yeah. Certainly with statutory rape, for example, there have been a number of cases coming up recently with teachers who got involved with their high school students, and identical cases where a male teacher gets involved with a young teenage student, or a female teacher gets involved with a young male student. And as you say, the female teachers, the vast majority of them get suspended sentences, basically get let off the hook. One of them, I think, got jailed for 6 months. For the men, it's minimum of 2 years, more often 5 years jail. So there's a huge disparity there in terms of the treatment of men and women under Australian law.
Well, yeah, and also in education, the fact that, as James was saying, that boys are doing so much worse, and the Sex Discrimination Act was actually used to prevent the schools from employing more male teachers, which is what the joint parliamentary inquiry into boys' education recommended. That was derailed by the Sex Discrimination Commissioner using the Sex Discrimination Act.
Right, so the Sex Discrimination Act, which should be all about equality between the sexes, was actually used to discriminate against men and against the interests of boys' education. I mean, young boys, I mean,
yeah.
Let's discriminate against them and, you know, make their educations worse for the sake of some strange feminist principle. It's bizarre.
Well, and I think that comes back to how the Act's worded. I mean, people talk about gender, but in a lot of cases that's a euphemism for non-male. People sort of, because men aren't mentioned specifically, or males aren't mentioned specifically anywhere in that Act, I don't really think, that it's actually quite legal to discriminate against men in Australia, or males or boys.
Yes, it's a strange situation we live in, and we're also signatories to international acts, like the Act against Discrimination Against Women, and that, once again, it's all about discrimination against women. That's very clear in the wording. It's
yeah.
only about discrimination against women. It's not about true gender equality. And discrimination against men is okay under those international acts that we're signatories to.
Well, yeah, and I think that's right. Sunlight is the best disinfectant in this sort of situation. So that's one of the reasons that I've gone to this website. It's just a matter of listing all these things and putting up examples and let people say, well, let people come up with an argument, oh, well, we do really want to do this, because I don't think there is many people who can argue that this is what we really want to do.
And I guess the thrust of all of this is that this is all funded by your tax dollars.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, Joe Blow, every Aussie, Australian, everyone who's paying taxes is actually paying for this system. Is that the main thrust behind the website?
Well, yeah, a lot of, when you sort of talk to people, you sort of get into it's like a discussion between it's a man and woman in the street. This isn't between a man and woman in the street. This is between a man and a taxpayer funded bureaucrat who's just interpreting things based on how women would like to see things rather than what's best for men and women.
Well, the family court, of course, is the classic of that, of how the presumption that a child should go to the mother,
yeah.
the way that it's been for the last 30-odd years, has absolutely discriminated against men to the point where women can go to court and lie themselves stupid. A man can produce witnesses proving these things are lies, and the whole thing gets dismissed, and the woman's hearsay evidence is held up as if it is somehow sacred.
Well, and you have Nicola Roxon, Shadow Attorney General, supposedly alternative law officer in the land, writing a dissenting report saying that they shouldn't be charged when there's proof of perjury, basically.
So what brought you to this?
Oh, well, I suppose I've had similar experiences to most other people, really.
I mean, have you been through the ringer of family law, or have you
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
Mm. It's very increasingly common experience. Okay, anything, I'm just winding up here, anything else that people should know about all this?
Well, I suppose that health, education, opportunity in employment, I think there's also a war against shared parenting in employment just as much as there is in the family court, in the opportunity for paternity leave and jobs that are more family-friendly that men get access to and things like that.
Right, we had the acting Victorian Sex Discrimination Commissioner on early this year, and she was saying that they're getting a record number of complaints from blokes who have asked for time off to, you know, look after sick kids and that sort of thing, and lost their jobs and all sorts of stuff. It's really, the workplace is, well, it's not friendly for parents of either sex, but it's especially unfriendly for dads, because dads are expected to be there working while mum takes time off to look after the sick kids, so... There's a big cultural shift that needs to take place there, absolutely.
Well, but you've got tax-funded departments who sort of package up this badging system of employers who are friendly to women and list them all and sort of send those off to women's networks and things like that. But presumably a lot of those employers would be just as friendly to men, but that information isn't made available for them for their job choices.
Okay, Max, so can you just give everybody the website and how to contact you if they need to?
Well, there's an email address on there. It's max@taxfundedprejudice, all one word, no spaces, .com.
Okay.
And Max, if...
The email address is www.taxfundedprejudice.com.
And if people have articles or anything that they would like you to consider to posting on that website, are you accepting that sort of material?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, so that's max@taxfundedprejudice.com. Max, thank you so much for coming on Dads on the Air today.
And also just mentioning, if people have got things about property settlement, I'm sort of running a list on all the sort of the little tricks that are sort of done through that. I'm happy to put those on the list too.
Fantastic. Thank you for letting us know, and good luck with the website. It should become a great resource over the years.
Thanks very much, John and Greg.
Cheers.
We're here at Parliament House in Canberra at the Land Fathers Conference in August 2007. We're talking with John Pearson.
Hello.
Well, hello there. Now, why have you come to this conference today?
I've had a lot of experiences with a lot of the systems, the family court system, the child support agency, and now I'm one of the first people who are appealing the SSAT in their role as a...
And for those who don't know what that is, what is it?
Social Security Appeals Tribunal, which was one of the most recent changes to the legislation in the child support system.
Now, that's an enormously complex process, appealing to the SSAT, isn't it?
Yes, and what's happened over, I suppose, over 12 and a half years is I've become better at understanding how the system works, how the legislation functions, and how to deal with the systems and the bureaucracy.
Now, this was one of the supposed reforms by this government, was that you could appeal the decisions by the Child Support Agency to this SSAT organisation. Is it an effective reform?
My experience is from January this year, where I found it difficult to present all the evidence required, basically because you're not allowed to subpoena evidence or witnesses and you can't cross-examine. So there's some fundamental things which seem to have been removed from the process which would have normally been applied in the Federal Magistrates or the Family Court if you appealed this CSA decision.
And often I've noticed in these attempts at appeal processes that they only allow certain information and don't allow other information. Are those sort of processes taking place?
What I experienced was that the information presented was a set of information from the Child Support Agency, but even during the interview process, where I presented other information anecdotally and as, if you like, stated fact, I didn't find out until after the event which information they chose to rely on and which they didn't. So you have no way of knowing what they're going to use as evidence and what they're not until they make a decision. The trap of this, and this is an important point, is that once they've made a decision, you can only appeal on a basis of law, not on a basis of which evidence was right or wrong or what they missed out on. So I find it very frustrating.
So an error of fact that they've made these decisions on completely incorrect information, or they've made a completely incorrect decision, is not appealable, is it?
It's not appealable. It's only appealable on the basis of law, and the argument then is, I've been advised, is natural justice. Now, the arguments I have to put forward in terms of natural justice are equivalent in complexity as someone might have to mount to a high court.
So really, this whole thing that, you know, you can now appeal decisions and they're shocking and often arbitrary and outrageous decisions made by child support officers, and I know from personal experience, completely dishonest decisions, there's nothing you can do. It's just another facade by this government at pretending to improve a system which is getting progressively worse.
Yeah, I would agree with some of that. I can't understand what the thinking was about putting the SSAT in between the Child Support Agency and the court process. It seems to me that my rights have been reduced, the process has been made more complex, and it was all about maybe getting quicker decisions and decisions through the door rather than providing anyone with a real sense of a proper due process and fair representation.
There's no proper due process in any of this, and just from your experience, we've had the General Manager of the Child Support Agency in here yesterday trying to convince everyone that the system was so much better. What's your view, and what was your view of what he said?
I have a long association with the Child Support Agency because I used to work in the bureaucracy that was closely associated with it, and I understand their systems, the people in it, and the bureaucracy, and how it works. I have also personal experience with the Child Support Agency. I found the comments by the head of the CSA to be refreshing in terms of the attempt to deal with the cultural problems in the Child Support Agency, because certainly it's my direct experience that there are significant problems in not only the culture, but the effectiveness, efficiency, and even the competence of some of the staff in their operations.
And when you say culture, what do you mean?
From my experience, I seem to have I see deep-seated problems in the Child Support Agency in their expectations of roles on a gender basis. So deep-seated that when the arguments take place or discussions take place, they are unable to continue the discussion or even hold a rational discussion about the matter. And in some cases, they will hang up unilaterally on a phone call saying that they're unable to discuss the matter any further.
They're a much despised institution, and it's been one of the great failings of the Howard government, their failure to reform it. We're talking with John Pearson. He's one of the few individuals at the Loan Fathers Conference held in August 2007 at Canberra Parliament House, who was an individual rather than just a group. We'll be back in a moment.
Coming up now, we have a fantastic new track recently recorded. It's by Horizon Shine. It's called My Boy.
He's a single father. He's attending the Lone Fathers Conference in Canberra, August 2007. Welcome back to Dad's on the Air.
Thanks.
Now, you live in Canberra and know an awful lot of bureaucrats, and a lot, I understand, of bureaucrats are now clients of the Child Support Agency and have incredible difficulties with them, just like the normal rest of the population.
Yes, I've got to say that being... I have worked in the public service for many years, and I understand the bureaucracy, how it works. I understand the public service. I've learnt a lot about the legislation, particularly the family law and the child support systems, and I know that this must be the most difficult system to navigate for even people who know how it works. I cannot imagine how someone with no experience in bureaucracies or law could ever navigate the complexity of the child support legislation, the Family Law Act, and even dealing with other service organisations like the Ombudsman. I don't know how people are supposed to know what to do, how, what their rights are, and how to proceed. It's extremely complex.
So really, why hasn't Howard fixed this? Is it because he sees no votes in men and thought it was all the votes were for women, or why didn't he fix this?
I probably have a different view to the one you expect on this matter. I think that there has been a tendency to use bureaucracies and legislation as solutions to problems where they shouldn't be. Situations, particularly with families and expectations of how people are supposed to behave, shouldn't be legislated and interfered with to the level that they are by governments, in my view. The intervention by governments using legislation and bureaucracies with enormous powers is just growing out of control.
And really, everyone thought that John Howard was a small government person, that he was for minimal government, but we've seen this massive spread of bureaucracy and welfare into the middle classes and massively complex processes. We're turning into a communist country, aren't we?
I don't know about that. But if you have a set of politicians whose only mechanism for implementing change is to make more laws, then it seems to be a sign of success is to continue to make as many laws as they possibly can. I don't know how that helps people who are subject to those laws, and I don't know if that's the right approach.
We're talking with John Pearson. We'll be back in a moment. We're talking with John Pearson at the Lone Fathers Conference in Canberra, August 2007. Welcome back.
Thanks.
Now, there's been a lot of politicians through here, the Attorney General, Chris Ellison, the Minister responsible for the Child Support Agency, Attorney General Ruddick, the Shadow Attorney General. We've had an overwhelming number of pollies through here. What message do you think they should take?
The message I think they should take, and they've obviously seen it, is that there's a large number of concerned individuals who have a lot of concerns with the way the system's working at the moment. They represent the tip of the iceberg, and I think the message they really need to get is that the vast bulk of the Australian community is very unhappy with the way the system is operating and are very concerned with what's happening to all sectors of society, including men, women and children, and that I would encourage all Australians to become more vocal in expressing their opinions and their feelings about how they think the system should be operating.
We have we rank 35th in the world in terms of press freedom, and we've got this ever-spreading tentacle bureaucracy, which is marvellous at making work for itself. Aren't we really heading down a very dangerous path here?
The press freedom issue is an interesting one, given the legislation passed recently about the whistleblowers and the FOI changes and also the Privacy Act. They concern me. I think it's important that the press expresses views from the community in an open and fearless way. And I don't see that the legislative changes with the Privacy Act, the Freedom of Information Act, or the Whistleblowers Act, or the Whistleblowers legislation, I think those are the three main bits from memory, are helping that process at all.
So where are we heading?
It's a good question, and I think that's really up to the Australian voters, because they're the ones who have the say in this matter, and they should get their voice and express it about what they want our society to be.
Well, really, they've got Tweedledum and Tweedledee out there. There isn't much room for expression. What can they do?
There's all... Political parties can be established and members can stand up for their rights. Everyone needs to become more focused on being really sure of what they think is right and wrong and taking a stand. We have a society where maybe people think, oh, it doesn't affect me, it doesn't matter. You've got to understand that what's happening now with the legislation and the other changes is it will affect you, and it will affect your children, and it will affect your relationships, and it will affect everyone you know. So the time to change is now.
We've been talking with John Pearson at the Lone Fathers Conference in Canberra. Thank you so much for coming on to Dad's on the Air.
I love you, Daddy. I wish your pain would go away.
I watch you hold up the paper and hide your face from the world. In all of your hiding, your silence grows deeper. And all of your silence, I know your heart really cries. So how can you give me the love that I need when you just don't know how, when you're just too afraid? When you just don't know how, when you're just too afraid. Please don't be afraid. Broken father, can you hear me? Can you just let me in? Broken father, can you hug me? Can you just take my hand? Because I accept you, I forgive you, and I'm trying to understand your pain.
Daddy.
We're back.
On the line now from Canberra, we have, from the Fatherhood Foundation, Mr. Warwick Marsh. Are you there, Warwick?
It's so good to hear your voice.
Now, what are you doing down there in Canberra again? You seem to be spending a lot of time down there lately. What are you down there for this week?
Well, Greg, it's like this. You've got to keep on knocking on doors. If you want a door to open, you've got to keep on knocking on the door. Today, we're right in the middle of a national strategic conference, actually a national strategic summit on marriage, family and fatherhood. The statistics show us that when marriages succeed, fathers and mothers are happier, children are happier, and society is a happier place. And financially, there's a lot of benefits for marriage, and we want to encourage marriage. We've had a divorce culture where we've just basically drop-kick marriage. It doesn't matter. And we've had that for 30 years. And really, it's just contributed to the fracturing of society. We've got to change that to become a culture where we actually honour each other, we love each other, and we work at our marriages. And so this is all about encourage marriage and affirming our gender and our gender uniqueness and complementarity, and of course making sure that we don't fall into a lot of traps when we miss the boat in these areas.
Yes, well, of course, we know that if you do have problems in your relationship, it's very easy to ring the police, who will come and remove the male from the house. It's easy to get a divorce lawyer who will separate you, but there aren't that many options. If your marriage is in trouble and you want help to hold it together, there's plenty of societal help to wrench you apart, split up your assets and drag your children away from you.
Indeed there is. And what we've got to try to do is to actually can reverse that culture and find ways to, to have, marriage guidance, marriage preparation courses before people get married, so people know. Teaching marriage and relationships at high schools, so young people actually get an idea that relationships are always a challenge, and that, coming together as a male and female of the species is quite a challenging experience for both parties. And you have to work through a whole bunch of issues. Men and women think differently, they communicate differently. They are different for 100 different reasons. And, of course, that doesn't mean they're not equal. They are equal but different. And we've had a society that said we're equal, which is well and good, but at the same time we've dumbed down the differences and we've just tried to make men and women exactly the same, which has actually destroyed marriages instead of helping marriages.
Right, I've always thought it's kind of bizarre that we teach sex education in high school, which is, well and good, but we don't teach relationship education. And when you're there, you're a young boy or a young girl, and you're, negotiating with a relationship or a dating relationship with someone of the opposite sex, you know about the nuts and bolts of the physical stuff, but you don't get any advice on the important stuff, which is what your relationship's all about, which is communication and understanding where the other gender's coming from, and that's not being taught at all, which has always struck me as kind of bizarre.
Yeah, I think we know, our society knows a lot about sex and how to have, multiple orgasms and this and that and that and this, but I think we don't know a lot about love. And love actually is the challenge of daily committing yourself to the other person in a relationship, and it's just not taught, it's just not promoted, it's just not encouraged. And of course Hollywood has done a lot of damage. We've sort of Hollywood-fied marriage, and the happily ever after story of course is not really the truth. It's, in many ways, marriages, I heard Frank Devine from The Australian say once, marriage is a furnace. And if you understand that indeed marriage is a furnace and will be tested by fire in your relationship, you start to grab hold of the reality of life and that life is all about giving, not getting. And look, Greg, I couldn't agree with you more. We've got to find a way to encourage young people, encourage those growing up to understand that relationships is not all about sex. Yeah, sure it is about sex, but it's not all about sex. It's about giving, it's about serving, and it's about caring. And when we start to understand that, we can rescue our society. And until we do, we're going to have a lot of problems.
Who have you got speaking down there?
Well, John, we've got actually Attorney General Philip Ruddock, who I think you know.
We've heard of him, yep.
Philip is coming along at 12:30, and the Shadow Attorney General, Joe Ludwig, who spoke at the Fathers Conference. He's speaking. We've also got Barry Williams, who's popped in as one of the delegates. And we've got a number of distinguished guests, like Professor Pat Noller from Queensland University, professor of psychology, and she's a proponent of marriage and family, and very much encourages fatherhood and motherhood and the things that we stand for and the things that Dads on Air stand for, which is great. They had Professor Romano Parola, who's a professor of medicine at New South Wales University. He's also spoken. He's a great proponent of marriage. So we've got some very distinguished people, some great academics, and a lot of wonderful people. In fact, one of the guard from Dads on Air is here, Mr. James Adams. So you're well represented, guys. You can be assured that your voice has been heard, and there's a voice for fathers and for family in the midst of all this wonderful day, this wonderful summit.
And what do you want to achieve from it?
Yeah, what is it that government can do? Because a lot of this stuff is obviously in the area of personal relationships, and, you know, a lot of us are a bit sick of, you know, the government bureaucracy, you know, putting its tentacles into our personal lives, which is sort of understandable. But what are you asking government to do on today with the summit?
Well, today's a very exciting day. We're releasing two documents. One document is our major flagship, which is a marriage manifesto, which is basically a call for renewal of marriage, a call for funding of a voucher system for marriage education for those who want to take it. It's not compulsory, it's just a voucher system, $200 for any young couple that want to actually take that before they actually tie the knot, which makes a lot of sense to me. You know, we're giving people a baby bonus, but we're not actually giving them a relationship bonus. We need to find ways to actually resource relationships. We're resourcing the family law court, we're resourcing relationship centres, which are essentially almost in the act of dissolving marriages, but we should be actually putting the money at the front end, trying to save the marriage breakdown in the first place. So, I mean, that's essentially what we're doing here. It's there's a lot of practical things in that marriage manifesto. What I'll do is I'll send it up to you guys at Dads on Air, and you can post it on your website as a resource document, and feel free to flick it around to all and sundry, including their politicians. And you'll find I've actually got some very interesting statement about family law in there, that we need to have a complete review, not just a minor review, but a complete review of the whole Family Law Act, and look at its essential fundamentals, and to see it completely rebuilt from the ground up. Does that sound like a good idea to you?
That sounds like a great idea. It's just a shame that you didn't get that point across to them last year when they were rewriting the legislation.
Well, it's a patchwork quilt at the present moment, unfortunately, and, you know, that's what it is.
But that's a very nice way of putting it, Warwick. Very diplomatic.
Mm. All right, so you think it's realistic?
Well, John, I think it has to be realistic because we have to see a renewal of a culture of relationship and love in Australia. And, you know, what you guys are doing in Dads on Air is awesome. You're encouraging fathers. You're also speaking up for justice and parity. And we must bring parity into the family law. I believe that's a big part of renewing marriage, because at the present moment, there's not a lot of parity when a divorce happens. It's winner takes all, which is not certainly usually the father. And, you know, there's both lose in divorce. There's no doubt about that. There's both get heartbroken, and we're not suggesting that one should be, you know, don't want to penalise people, but let's at least make things equal, and let's make things fair. And in doing that, we actually just discourage the process of divorce in the first place.
And I think if the studies have indicated that if you weather the rough times, many couples who stay together for long periods are much happier than if they had split up.
Mm, absolutely correct.
Yeah, not only happier but healthier as well. There's lots of health studies showing that married people long term have much better health outcomes, and obviously the children as well do infinitely better in intact marriages, no matter what certain parts of the community and researchers may say. There's a lot of evidence that kids do much better in intact families in married with both parents who are married, and that's undeniable.
It's undeniable, Greg. It's undeniable, yeah.
All right, mate. I know you've got to get back to the conference. Any final words?
Look, I just want to encourage the dads who are listening today. Go for gold for your kids, because your kids do matter. I know there's probably a lot of single dads listening today. And if I could say one thing, your children are important. And sometimes when we go through these difficult times in a relationship, and marriages do break down, unfortunately, and things do go wrong, because we're all imperfect. I'm certainly imperfect. You want to talk to my wife, and she'll soon tell you that. The bottom line is our children are important, and I applaud you in your struggle to see your children, to be with your children. Don't give up. Keep sending those letters. Keep making those phone calls. Keep sending those emails. And, you know, your children will want to know you tried. And that's my message to dads that are struggling out there. For the dads that have got shared care, that's great, that's wonderful. You're amongst a rare group of fathers, and I congratulate you. Keep up the great work. And for those dads in intact families, work at your marriages, work at your relationships. Don't take what you have for granted, because what you have is like gold, and it's precious. And you don't know what you got till it's gone.
That was Warwick Marsh speaking from Canberra at the Marriage Conference. He's the head of the Fatherhood Foundation, doing a terrific job as always. We'll be back in a moment.
With me, I looked into my father's eyes. We're back with Dads on the Air.
Now on the line we have Dr. Dad from the Dad Lab. Are you there, Dr. Dad?
Yeah, good morning, Ian.
Good morning. How are you this morning?
Well, how are you?
I'm very well indeed. Now, what are we going to be talking about this morning? I believe you want to be talking about a particular French term, couvade, I believe. I don't know if my pronunciation is correct.
No, that's correct, Ian. Couvade, a French term to describe a phenomenon that seems to be universal amongst expectant and new fathers.
Okay, do you want to tell us a little bit about what it actually is and what's involved in it?
Well, the traditional literature on couvade has established that a certain percentage of expectant and new fathers act out symptoms similar to the mother in terms of pregnancy symptoms and the desire to be engrossed in the care of their child.
Yep.
But traditionally, the medical literature, psychiatry literature, family courts around the world, family report writers have demonised men.
They've referred to it as womb envy, I believe.
Womb envy, yes. And in actual fact, they're all wrong. The demonisation of men has effectively been based on their lack of reading the literature that's emerging at the moment.
Okay, well, you've got some of that literature available. You're going to quote some of these studies.
Yes,
that are...
In 2000, a paper was published called Hormonal Correlates of Paternal Responsiveness in New and Expectant Fathers by Story, Walsh, Quinton and Wynn Edwards.
Yep, and what did they have to say about that?
This study was actually done in humans. Previously, it had been done in animal models.
Okay.
But this one was actually done in humans. And what they discovered was that in the third trimester of a woman's pregnancy, that the father's hormonal levels of prolactin and cortisol actually rose, and they're similar hormones that rise in the pregnant mother. So that there seems to be a parallel process happening biologically.
Now, these hormones, what kind of hormones are they specifically? What do they relate to in a man's body?
Well, prolactin in the woman is the hormone that primes her for being able to express milk. Cortisol is a stress hormone, so priming the mother to be able to cope with the stress of a new child. But we think that in the new father, prolactin, because obviously fathers can't express milk,
yes.
That it has profound effects on his biology in terms of bonding, specifically.
Okay, so you're saying that a father is biologically prepared for bonding in the last trifecta of the mother's pregnancy?
Yeah, last trimester.
Not trifecta. Yeah. Sorry about that. My
so
my
they
racing
basically
pedigree.
Start acting like their wives, do they? What do they start? What's it do to them? What do they start acting like?
Basically, these hormones, John, prime the males to provide care for the young.
Ah.
But after the child's born, there's a reduction in testosterone in the male.
Mm.
So that, you know, that aggression that testosterone sometimes drives is reduced significantly.
Yes, and sex drive, probably.
And sex drive, yeah. Because
we're leaving it's, a pure...
It's in the new child's... And in women, estradiol actually reduces, which is their sex hormone.
Oh.
So basically the two new parents, the mother and father, basically have reduced sex drive so that they can devote all their energies to the contributing to the normal brain development of their child rather than reproducing and having another child come along the way so that the full attention is split away from the first child.
Okay, so what's the scientific basis of what would trigger this change in hormone levels in fathers? I mean, with mothers we can understand that they've got a new being in their womb and obviously that affects, that's, you know, where the physical effects come from. How does it happen with men?
The same phenomenon occurs for expectant and new fathers. It's proximity to the fetus, with the mother being the bridge. So it's proximity and the amount of time that the new... So obviously if a pregnant mother-to-be and the father are sleeping in the same bed at night before the child's born, the father is going to be biologically primed to provide the care for the newborn.
Right, we're running out of time. Morris, can you sum up the findings for us?
Well, the findings basically indicate that, well, researchers have indicated that this process is gearing fathers to protect the mother-child dyad, so that fathers are husbanding that relationship. But the research that's emerging is saying, yeah, that's only half the truth. The other half of the truth is that fathers are being primed to have a direct relationship with their children without the mother's intervention as such, so that health promoters really need to understand that primary biological connection a father has with his child and develop public policy to recognise that, number one, and to develop programs to strengthen that process. And obviously the Family Courts of Australia need to understand that too and stop demonising men and start to promote this as a health issue.
So what you're saying is there are physiological disadvantages to a father if he is separated from his child?
Those physiological disadvantages are being written up in the literature as what's called paternal postpartum depression. And that has a direct correlation with the child's health. So that not recognising this process in men is fundamentally contributing to health issues of the newborn.
Well, when you think about it from a biological and an evolutionary perspective, up until a couple of hundred years ago, the death rate for mothers during pregnancy was extraordinarily high. So a vast percentage of mums would actually die in childbirth. Therefore, of course, it makes sense for the dad to be biologically primed to look after the kids on his own in the case of the mother's death. So it makes a lot of sense, and from all sorts of perspectives, what you're saying today, Morris.
Yeah, and as I said, no one seems to be recognising this here in Australia, and they really need to start reading the literature, because by neglecting the literature, they're contributing to poor health outcomes, not only for fathers and mothers, but most importantly, for children.
That was Dr. Dad from the Dad's Lab. Thank you so much for coming on to Dad's on the Air.
Thanks, guys.
He'll be back in a fortnight's time. That's our Dr. Dad fortnightly segment. We'll be back.
You're back with Dad's on the Air. Now, as regular listeners would know, in July I went to Washington, D.C. in the States to the Boys and the Boy Crisis conference over there. And one of the speakers that I caught up with was Professor Gordon Finley, PhD, from Florida International University. Now, Gordon gave an excellent presentation talking about the long-term social and occupational implications of the new gender divide in higher education. As listeners probably know, many more females than males attend our universities these days, and Gordon talked about the implications of that. Apologies again for some of the audio quality here. I caught Gordon at the end of the conference and there were people packing up tables and chairs in the background, but if you bear with it, it's a great interview. I'm here with Gordon E. Finley, PhD. He's the Professor of Psychology at Florida International University. Gordon, in Australia, we have a graduation ratio males to females, which is 63% female and 37% male. First of all, is this a situation in America, and do you see this as a static scenario, or do you see things potentially getting worse in terms of this gender imbalance at our universities?
In the United States today, most data sources argue that if you look at undergraduate enrollment, it's about 60% female. If you look at graduate enrollment, because professional schools, it's about 60% female. The only place that it changes is if you look at what we have associate arts degrees, which are vocationally oriented degrees, there you get about 60% males. This has been increasing over the years. It started off prior to probably about 1980 that there were more males, then there became equal, and now there are overwhelmingly more females in all areas. Will it stay static? No. My forecast is that unless we intervene, and I'll come back with some interventions in a moment, unless we intervene, it will go from 40-60 to 30-70 to 20-80 to 10-90 and 0-100. The reason for this is there are built-in forces both in terms of admitting students to the university, but also the university environments, particularly those universities that have women's studies programs, gender studies programs, feminist faculty, pro-feminist male faculty. All of those forces operate to make the university an unfriendly environment for men. And as long as the university remains an unfriendly environment for men, men are going to drop out. The other thing is that men need to be looking down the road and seeing that they have job opportunities. In America, what we see is most of the jobs, we talk about the glass ceiling, but women are breaking through the glass ceiling. The media publicity is how well girls and women are doing, and men are responding to that by having lowered motivation, dropping out of school, making less progress. We need to get back to equality. We need to treat men and women equally in terms of not only university admissions, but how they're treated on campus. That men have to feel comfortable on campus. They can't feel threatened because of feminist ideology on campus. And critically, they have to see that there are going to be jobs for them at the end of the road. No man is going to put himself through whatever and however many years of university education if he does not believe that he has an equal chance at a good job at the end. So where does the interventions come in? You got to do three things. One, you got to look at your admissions. I don't know what the admissions are in Australia, but you have to admit 50-50. You have to be in half boys, half girls, half men, half women. You need to provide incentives. You need to have men's studies programs as well as women's studies programs. In the United States, there are virtually no men's studies programs. They're all women's studies programs. Some of these women's studies programs are terrific. They consider both the man's and the woman's perspective. Others are very vicious. They're very anti-male. They hate males. They're male-hating. These are the ones that produce not only faculty, but students who make the university an unfriendly environment for men. So that
now that's not like, just in the in their own domain, is it? Do you find that that feminist influence has spread from not just women or gender studies, but into across the disciplines?
You know, we used to think of the university as a male-dominated institution, but if you look today and you look, say, well, at your home university, ask yourself, is there a women's center? The answer will be yes. Is there a men's center? Generally, the answer will be no. Is there a women's studies program? There will be a certificate program, a department, a graduate program, maybe even a PhD program in women's studies. There will be nothing in men's studies. That horrific imbalance causes the university environment to become feminist-oriented and prohibits males from having an opportunity to develop their own interests, to move forward, to get degrees. And again, I really believe that you have to have hope. That is, if you're going to spend 4 years of your life and a lot of your money for tuition and books and stuff like that, you have to believe that it's going to pay off for you. And if you only see women getting jobs, if women are only being advertised as succeeding in life, males simply are going to say, why? Why should I do this? Why should I spend 4 years of my life going through university? And down the road, the really critical part, which women refuse to recognize, heterosexual women refuse to recognize, is the issue is, who am I going to marry? If all of the jobs, again, in America, I don't know about Australia, but in America, the route to upward mobility is through education. That's how you get ahead. And if it's only women, or predominantly women, who are going through, who are graduating, moving into the professions, going to graduate school, going into professional school, getting these kinds of jobs, working hard, working 40, 50, 60, 70 hours a week that it takes to succeed in a career, at some point they may well decide, hey, it's time to have a family. They're going to look around and say, where are the men? And the answer is the men aren't going to be there because they have not been getting educated. They have dropped out of school.
Or the men are the plumbers and the roofers.
Right. They've gone into vocational trades. They've seen the handwriting on the wall. They've seen that all the good jobs are going to women. They know they've got to make a living, otherwise they're going to starve. So they go into the vocational trades. And the critical question is, are these women going to marry the plumber? See, men have always been willing to marry down. That is, successful doctors have loved to marry nurses. Successful people in every field, successful men in every field have always been willing to trade their education, their occupation, their income for physical beauty, for a nice personality, a good mother, whatever quality they're looking for in a wife. But the question is, and it's an unanswered question, is will these women who have moved up and broken through the glass ceiling, will they also be willing to marry down? And I think the answer is no. I think
and
they won't.
If the answer is no, what are the implications for demographics and for the birth rate? And if we have possibly a ratio of 2-to-1 of professional women to professional men, that means half the women are going to end up partnerless and potentially childless. So what are the social implications?
The new Australian spinster. I don't know if you use that word in Australia now, but we talk about American spinsters, you know, and you will have the new Australian spinster. You will have women who cannot find the... It's not that they can't find men. Australia is full of men, but they can't find the man they want. And because they have been so successful marching up the career ladder, they have a list, they have a shopping list, they have a list of demands for the kind of man that they want. But when men are denied the opportunity to get an education, when they're denied the opportunity to get into a professional school, when they're denied the opportunity to get a good job, when these women reach the point where they decide, oh, I've done enough in the career, it's time to get married, have the family settle down, they are going to have difficulty finding a man to settle down with.
Let's get back to some of the interventions. I'll just like to paraphrase you from your presentation today. You talked about the constant drumbeat of girl power that on campus, often in an environment which is dominated by women, which is kind of strange for the men who are there and very toxic for them. What do you think could be done to make the atmosphere on campus more male friendly?
I think this really requires governmental intervention, where are you, most of your universities in Australia government funded or are they private?
Most of them are government funded.
Okay. This requires in government intervention. The government has to say, hey, the road we're going down now is going to have very serious social consequences for our population policy, for our child-rearing policy, for our marriage policy. You're talking about social policy where the government currently is following a trend that is the feminist trend of allowing only women to move up, or primarily predominantly women to move up. It's going to be a huge social cost for them if they don't switch over and create positive attitudes. The answer is you have to create positive attitudes for boys. You can't have T-shirts that say, boys are stupid, throw rocks at them. You can't have T-shirts that say, girl power. You can't have T-shirts that say, go, girl, go. You have to have equality. The only way that women who do succeed are going to find mates that they're going to want to establish relationships with, or is if you allow men, you change things, you change the social attitudes. You see, in the United States, the long-term strategy is you have to change the social attitudes. You have to develop positive stereotypes about boys, positive attitudes towards boys, and at the same time, get rid of all the negative stuff. That is, the government has to intervene and say, look, this is hate speech. This is making... this is workplace harassment. You know, if boys or men in the university are being told their opinions are not valued in class, if they're attacked by feminists in class, if the teachers permit this, this is going to make their workplace, that is their study place, unattractive. They're going to leave. The government has to say, okay, feminism has achieved its goal. We now need to move back to equality. The ultimate goal should be, in my view, equality, equal opportunity, equal educational opportunity for both men and women, equal occupational opportunity for men and women, but that's the only system that's going to work. And you can't just focus on career, you can't just focus on education, you have to focus on the long-term social implications. The lifespan doesn't end at college. The lifespan doesn't end 5 years into your career. You've got the rest of your life ahead of you. And if you want to spend it alone, terrific. You can be the new Australian spinster. If you want to spend it with a man, if you're a lesbian, you don't care. But if you want to spend it with a man who has your interests, roughly your income, who has an occupation and a job that you find interesting to talk about, you have to have an educational system, a dual-track educational system where both boys and girls, men and women, progress through, get up to the top, and then you will be able to find a compatible mate at that level. If it's only women progressing, and if it's men falling down to the brick floor, I often talk about the glass ceiling and the brick floor, if the women are going through the glass ceiling and the men are falling down to the brick floor, there is a cost to the men who are hitting the brick floor, but the long-term cost will be to the women who've broken through the glass ceiling, look around, looking for a mate, and they don't find one. The new Australian spinster.
On that note, I think we'll leave it. Professor Finley, it's been a great pleasure talking with you today. Let's hope that... with some of the outcomes from a conference like this, that the government will start listening and we might see a move towards a better gender balance in our universities.
He went to war when he was 15.
He was a very decent
Second World
man.
War. He was
an honest
really
man.
Nice fellow. Very, and very loving.
I think he's given
and
to
he
me
cherished all of us.
He's probably the coolest guy that I know that's in his late 70s.
Having to belong to the community and do as much as you can for the community.
He's a very mellow person.
To contact him and tell him what I feel. Better than I expected, actually. Yeah, it was good.
He was never really there for me.
And it doesn't matter what happens, he's always really level.
Never a demonstrative person. Like, I didn't expect him to sort of be gushing or anything like that, but he sort of basically said, I feel the same way as what you explained to me. It was really good.
Yeah, he was a great example to me. And, yeah, my father had a wonderful career.
He was always there for me
did very well,
as he still is,
in terms of success. But
wonderful father and
was never,
friend. And
full of himself.
I just hope that I can do half as good a job as he did.
And he was always
fair,
very
straightforward, honest.
Easy to get along with.
Great sense of humour.
He was a wonderful
and,
gentleman.
And he still carries those qualities now.
It was very sad to see him go, which he did gracefully.
And next week we've got a fascinating interview with the authors of Fighting Misandry. Can you give us a background on that?
Absolutely. I've conducted this interview at the Boys and the Boys Crisis Conference. Dr. Paul Nathanson and Dr. Catherine Young, they're Canadian academics. They're the authors of two very important books that uncover the underlying contempt for men and boys in our culture today. And one's called Spreading Misandry. The second is called Legalizing Misandry. And there's actually two more books on the way. Basically, they ask what happens in a society that not only fails to acknowledge the entry into manhood, but also refuses to provide an acceptable view of manhood in the first place. The evidence looks very grim. Obviously, we've got statistics on suicide and boys dropping out of school, but they want to ask what's going on, and they suggest that these are actual symptoms of a much deeper problem, and people are either unaware of this problem or are unwilling to do something about it. And they say, in that sense, it's analogous to what Betty Friedan called women's disease with no name, and they've named this now, and it's called misandry, which is the male version of misogyny, and it's rampant in Western culture. So very interesting.
Misandry, the hatred of men. That'll be next week. We'll be back.